This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow. A real person.
Yep. I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow. I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule. And there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something...
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 40% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Here we go, Tuesday, March 18th, a brief respite between St. Patrick's and St. Joseph's Day. We had a nice conversation about the history of the Irish yesterday, and you can go to WWL.com, click on my name if you like, and find that segment and listen to it, or you can always download the Odyssey app and use the rewind feature. This week is going to be just beautiful. And before you know it, as we approach the end of March here, it's going to turn hot and humid and be brutally hot and humid during the summertime. So I would just suggest, if you can, get out and enjoy this weather if you can. Highs in the mid-70s today and tomorrow. Then a little cool front comes through, 66 for a high Thursday. Windy as well, 68 Friday, 75 Sunday, 74 Sunday. So 75 Saturday, yeah, 74 Sunday. So the weather for the parade should be great. Let's talk about tariffs. So right now it's a little bit chilly, 51 degrees. Let's talk about tariffs and manufacturing and so forth. Our guest is Willie Shee, a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for taking the time with us today. Let's talk about, and I'm looking at a story here about President Trump and American manufacturing and trying to, I guess, bring manufacturing back to the United States. And I think one thing that I've not really heard talked of here is a time frame for that to happen, because you're talking about companies reacting to tariffs and then making long-term capital decisions, right, on capital investment. Address all
right.
that, if you will, Professor.
Well, you know, companies have to plan for the long term. So when we have an environment like we do today where, you know, today there's going to be a tariff, and then tomorrow maybe we back off, and then the day after it's something different. We have an environment with a lot of uncertainty. So right now, the way most companies are responding to tariffs are, well, let me import as much as I can before those tariffs hit, but I'm not making any decisions until I get a little clarity on, you know, what the long-term environment looks like.
I was reading a story here from CNN about... Americans could wind up with inferior cars at higher prices. And this goes to what you told us about parts crossing the border back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And got me to thinking about back in the day, American manufacturers had a lot of trouble with imports, or at least it cut into their market share because at that time, the imports were a superior product. And I guess subsequently, and you can correct me, Professor, if I'm wrong on any of this, it's just my memory. At some point, they became hybrids, the vehicles did, and a combination of, it's hard to tell what's an American car and what's a foreign car because of some foreign cars are made here. Parts come from different areas, as you said, cross the border back and forth. And I think, at least from my perception, the competition kind of all blended together because there's not a lot of difference between a Chevy or an Audi other than Prestige or maybe a Ford or a Jaguar, whatever you want to say, because it seems as though the manufacturing, the parts, et cetera, have improved. And my concern here is that we could go back to a situation where we had a foreign product as opposed to a domestic product, and consumers shopped and voted with their wallets and decided to get the car that was more dependable. Am I making stuff up in my head here? Does any of that resonate?
No, Tommy, I think you have a good sense of history. What happened is back in the 1970s was when we first saw this onslaught of inexpensive Japanese vehicles from
Toyotas
companies
like, and Datsun, right?
You bet. Okay, and they were flooding into the country. Okay, and the Detroit makers looked at that and said, "Huh, it must be unfair competition, right?" It never occurred to them that maybe they could make a superior product. Okay, so then what happened is we had a lot of import limitations. There were voluntary quotas and stuff like that, which actually caused, like, the Japanese makers led by Toyota, Honda, Nissan, all to set up factories in the U.S. Okay, so, I mean, actually, if you look at Toyota's factory in Georgetown, Kentucky, or, you know, Honda, who's been in Ohio for decades now, they continue to churn out very competitive sedans. Now, the challenge for the Detroit guys is they haven't been able to make competitive sedans, so even to this day, they've been kind of hiding behind pickup trucks, which is where their profits are, and pickup trucks and things like, you know, first it was the Ford Explorer, but, you know, a lot of these SUVs built on truck chassis, mm-hmm. that's where their profit has been. That's where their advantage has been. For the low cost, what they've done is they've gone to, like, importing parts or even doing a lot of assembly in Mexico and Canada. Okay, so you have a lot of parts flowing in across the borders and a lot of, you know, actually assembly across the border. Okay, and then the Detroit guys have also relied on, like, foreign steel and aluminum, right? You probably saw with Ford, you know, their F-150, this is going to be like an existential crisis for them because if they have to pay tariffs on aluminum, there's a lot of aluminum in that F-150. And a lot of it comes from Canada. Okay, so now all of a sudden, you know, we got big trouble in Detroit.
So let me take a step back. As you talk about history, what led to the cessation, if you will, of Toyota, and at that time it was Datsun, then it became Nissan and Honda to a lesser extent, but then they built market share to steel share. What led them to go from beating the American manufacturers to bringing manufacturing here, I guess is what I'm trying to ask in my own clumsy.
Yeah. Well, what it was is back in the 80s, we had import quotas. Okay, so the Japanese makers led by Toyota, Honda in particular, realized that the only way they were going to grow in the U.S. was to build manufacturing plants in the U.S. Okay, and so that's what caused them to build these so-called transplant factories, and those transplant factories have actually done very well. As a matter of fact, I just visited the Toyota factory in Georgetown last summer, and, you know, they're cranking out these sedans, and I'm asking them, it's like, you know, how can you crank out sedans competitively in the U.S.? And it's like, partly, they got a more productive production process. They make them more efficiently, they got good design, you know, so the sedan market is really owned by the transplants now, and not only the Japanese, but also the Koreans, right?
And Kia and whatever it is.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Detroit guys really have to rely on trucks and SUVs, okay? But in the meantime, everybody has been importing parts and, you know, metals and stuff from Canada and Mexico. And so now all these tariffs are playing havoc with all that.
All right, let me take a break. A couple of questions when we come back. One of which is, what will effect will tariffs or could tariffs have on these transplant factories? Because it seems as though import quotas are off the table because the cars are made here now. And then the second question is, I don't understand when it comes to somebody like Ford and tariffs and aluminum, this isn't a fishmonger who says, okay, you know, you go to a restaurant, you order the fish for the entree and they say market price. I don't know how, with pricing structure, Ford can plan on costs and prices and everything else and continue to manufacture when they don't know what the cost of the raw material is going to be. But I bet you can explain it to us. Willie Shih is our guest, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. I wish everything was as simple as being a fishmonger, but it's not. 6:22 traffic now, WWL. 6:27 a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Professor Willie Shih, a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School, our friend, about tariffs. And if you're just joining us, we talked about the 80s and import quotas and how Japanese car companies were cutting into the auto market. Then they imported, then they set import quotas, and then that led to cars being manufactured here. Somebody texted in, Professor, good morning. One of my best friends has been a body shop guy for over 30 years. Worked on them all, drives a Chevy because he's just a Chevy guy, but he tells me that the Toyota product is superior in every way to any Ford, Chevy, or GM. He said they're engineered better, easier to work on compared to the U.S. brands. Also says there are more U.S.-made parts on Toyotas than there are on other vehicles. They are touting themselves as U.S. vehicles. It's hard to tell what's made in America and what's not, but in a few seconds that we have remaining here, how does Ford go about, or any manufacturer go about planning for production and pricing and everything else? Because as I said, it's not like the today's daily price of fish in a restaurant. How are tariffs going to affect all of that in their production plans?
Well, Tommy, that's going to be a big problem. And something that people haven't talked about much lately is tariff stacking. Okay, and tariff stacking means, wait a minute, I'm going to pay 25% tariff on the steel or aluminum, and then I'm going to pay 25% tariff on top of that if it comes from Canada. And a lot of these parts that come back and forth across the border, it's going to be an administrative nightmare just calculating what tariff is due on all these parts. You know, to answer your question, it's hard to plan right now because it changes every day. And that's why a lot of people are saying, I'm going to hold back on investment until I get some clarity on what I'm going to do, because right now you can't make any long-term plans.
So I guess somebody's advising the president on this, and he's got to believe it's going to work. As you and I have spoken about before, this happened with McKinley back in the day, but the idea then was to generate revenue for the Treasury, not to bring manufacturing back. How do you see this all playing out? How do you see it ending? What do you think the president's up to?
I wish I understood. Okay, but, you know, stuff is going to cost more, right? Because if nothing else, all this uncertainty, inability to plan, what people are going to do is they're going to have to build in some buffers on, you know, how much they charge, because they don't know how much they're going to be paying. We're already going to see this near term in the fruit and vegetable supply, you know, as we apply tariffs on stuff from Mexico, stuff like strawberries, you know, blueberries, all avocados, all those things are going to cost more, right? And in cars, it's going to take longer to play out. I predict it's going to end up costing you and me more when we buy a car.
That's not good. Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time.
Really, on that cheerful note,
look,
thanks.
Look, I got a 2014 CRV. I'm going to keep driving that thing until it dies, and then I'll just pat it on the fender and say, thank you, old paint, and move on. Willie Shih, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. We'll take a break, come back, talk about the U.S. and what's going on in Yemen with the Houthis. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It is currently about 6:46, 14 till 7. We're going to talk about what's going on with the Houthi rebels and try to explain who the players are and what's happening here. Like I said before the break, I don't think any foreign nation or foreign enemy of the United States should doubt President Trump's resolve when it comes to taking action. Lindsey Cohn joins us, associate professor at the U.S. Naval College, where he taught strategy, international security, U.S. foreign policy, and civil-military relations. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How are you?
Lindsey, I'm sorry. They cut and pasted and it said, I teach strategy. And I took a shot with Lindsey and I thought it was a man, but it turned out to be you. And I'm so sorry. I apologize for that. How are you this morning?
That's okay. I'm doing great, Tommy. Thanks.
Yeah, if it's any consolation, I have the same luck at the roulette table. I always pick wrong. Let's talk about what's going on. I guess we should start with who are the Houthi rebels and what is their goal in all of this?
Sure. And I do first have to say, since you mentioned that I work at the Naval War College, that I'm speaking in my personal capacity and my views do not represent those of the U.S. government.
Okay.
but so who are the rebels? So the Houthis are so we're talking about the country of Yemen, which is the southwestern end of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the corner there down at the edge of the Red Sea. And the Houthis are a group of people within Yemen who belong to a minority Shia sect called the Zaydis. Yemen is about two-thirds Sunni, one-third Zaydi, so it's not a tiny minority. But anyway, since about the 1990s, when there was a conflict between the what were the two halves of Yemen, north and south, the Houthis have been occasionally engaging in flare-ups and rebellions against the usual rule of the majority Sunni tribes. But it's important to recognize that in Yemen, this Sunni-Shia split is not the only or even most important sort of cultural split or identity. There are tribal identities, there are regional identities, there is a Yemeni identity. So it's important to recognize that this is not just a Sunni-Shia thing. There are other things going on there as well. The most recent uprising began back in the Arab Spring, or shortly after the Arab Spring. And the Houthis have since taken over a significant amount of what was North Yemen. And the recent fighting between sort of the U.S. and Israel and the U.K. and the Houthis stems from the attacks of Hamas on Israel on October 7th, 2023, and Israel's response to invade Gaza. And the Houthis have been firing at shipping in the Red Sea in support of the Palestinian cause. So that's where we are.
So it's a messy, multifaceted civil war. Is that accurate in Yemen?
Yes.
Okay.
You said it much more succinctly than I did. Sorry.
Well, I just, because I listened to what you told me. That's why, Lindsay. So when it comes to the motive here, is it a political statement or is it about just piracy and plundering?
No, it is a political statement. The Houthis are trying to establish themselves as the legitimate government of all of Yemen. That is contested, right? There is still another government claiming that they are the legitimate government of Yemen. From the Houthi perspective, these attacks show military capability. They show a solidarity with a pan-Arab cause, that is the Palestinian cause. And from the Houthi perspective, this is, number one, putting them on the map in the Arab world and giving them what you might call street cred or just legitimacy as a group that could and should be recognized as the government of Yemen. Also, you know, fighting against the U.S. and Israel is another sort of source of legitimacy for them with certain audiences in the region.
It's the Gulf of Aden. Is that where they're active in the Red Sea as well?
That's correct, yeah.
So would changing it to the Gulf of America change anything? I'm just kidding. I'm making a joke. When it comes to the effect on international shipping, in addition to there's a military aspect to this and there's a commercial commercial shipping aspect of this, right?
That's right.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. So the obviously the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, is the mouth of the route to the Suez Canal, to and from the Suez Canal. So this is an extremely important shipping region. I'm sure we all remember when the Suez Canal was blocked a couple of years ago and sort of everything stopped. The Houthis are targeting, they claim, and so far it has been pretty accurate, they claim that they are targeting only shipping related to Israel. And since the U.S. and U.K. were supporting Israel, U.S. and U.K. shipping as well. They have tried to reassure the European Union that they're not targeting anybody else. The European Union is skeptical. But even if they're only targeting certain ships, it still disrupts everything, right? So it does make shipping companies much more concerned about going through that route. So that means longer shipping times, insurance rates go up. So it makes things more expensive and it makes things more difficult. Now, the U.S. has been under President Biden and now under President Trump. Well, under President Biden, the U.S. was trying to shoot down a lot of the missiles that the Houthis were shooting at shipping. So very, very few ships were actually sunk, which is good. But it takes a lot of time and effort and resources to do that. The Trump administration has not been shooting down incoming missiles because the Houthis have not been shooting at anything since the ceasefire in Gaza. But they threatened to start shooting again given the current Israeli blockade on aid to Gaza. So they threatened to start shooting again, and the Trump administration said, well, we're going to shoot first. And they have targeted sites in Yemen, which the Biden administration did as well. But the Biden administration was doing both sort of shooting down incoming missiles and targeting sites in Yemen. The Trump administration, as of right now, is targeting sites in Yemen because there aren't any missiles coming at ships right now.
Well, let me take a break. We're talking about a multifaceted, messy civil war in Yemen that led to the rise of the Houthi rebels affecting shipping in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. When we come back, we'll talk about civilian casualties and the role of Iran and more with Lindsay Cohn, our guest, associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College, teaching strategy, international security, U.S. foreign policy, civil-military relations. To be sure, to be clear, rather, these are her opinions and is not that of the U.S. government. 6:53, 7 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:58, Tommy Tucker, WWO, about 90 seconds left with Lindsay Cohn, associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. She teaches strategy, international security, foreign policy, civil-military relations. Her opinions are those of herself, not the government. But Professor, let me get to this real quick. So yeah. You're talking about 53 people were killed, including children, wounding others. When it comes to Dresden in World War II, the U.S. and the Allies killed 25,000 civilians, over 200,000 in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. War is a dirty business. Civilian casualties, is it different when it comes to something like this or not?
In terms of effect, I don't think it's likely to have much effect. So there are sort of three possible aims the Trump administration might have with this. One would be to deter the Houthis from further attacks. Another would be to degrade their ability to do further attacks. And the third one is kind of to get at Iran via the Houthis. The deterrence mission, I don't think, is going to work. It didn't work with the Biden administration. They're already responding. So there's, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have died in the last 10 years during the civil war. This kind of civilian casualty rate is not going to get them to stop doing this.
Thank you, Professor. We'll talk again. We are in for a stretch of beautiful weather. Highs of 75 today. Right now it's 50. It's chilly. I was just outside with TEDDY. So highs of 75 today, 78 tomorrow, 66 Thursday, a little bit cooler, 68 Friday, 75 Saturday, 75 Sunday, and dry. Till a chance for showers on Monday. It's been so nice. I've been leaving the French doors on the patio wide open and letting outside come inside and inside go outside. And the same with the PUPPY, and everybody's been happy. Dr. Fred Lopez joins us now to talk about something that people are doing with measles, and it just is just eyebrow raising. Fred Lopez, our friend, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. How you doing, Dr. Fred?
Good morning, Tommy.
I'm going to say something here, and Tim, you can bring Dr. Fred down because this is my opinion, not his, and then we'll go back to Dr. Fred and talk about the science of this. Back in February, Louisiana Department of Health said that they're going to no longer encourage mass vaccination. That the state attorney general and his deputy said news release, social media, and that came from Dr. Ralph Abraham, who is a veterinarian physician, a Republican U.S. representative, who is now the I forgot his exact title, but he's the Surgeon General of Louisiana. That's what he is. Well, then later on, he said that they're on alert that the worst U.S. measles outbreak in decades is spreading in Texas and Mexico. Dr. Bill Cassidy, also a senator, said that it's making its way down the I-10. And he said Dr. Abraham is now saying the MMR is a good vaccine recommended for my parents and the children that they have. It does give good immunity. It's a two-dose vaccine. And I think that's what happens when politics gets in the way of medicine and science. They make for strange bedfellows, including Ralph Abraham doing one thing to stay in the good graces of the governor, his boss, and another thing under the auspices of being a doctor to give the best public health information that he possibly can. That's my opinion of it. That's over. Now let's go to Dr. Fred for the science. Good morning, Dr. Fred. How are you?
I am okay, Tommy. How about yourself?
Still okay. I just wanted to get that out before we started. So there's a story here from The Advocate by Alina Mashke about parents deciding to have measles parties to expose their kids to the measles vaccine as opposed to the measles virus as opposed to a vaccine. This is based on something that happened with chickenpox before there was a vaccine. So take me through all of this from the medical part, if you will, doctor, please.
Yeah, this harkens back to those days of chickenpox parties that you just mentioned. Bad idea then, very bad idea today. Measles parties, certainly concerning, worrisome, if they're really happening. Measles is something that many physicians have never seen before. The reason for that is because we have a vaccine that was introduced in early 1960s. In the decade before the vaccine was released in 1963, there were 400 to 500 people dying each year from measles in the United States, almost 50,000 hospitalizations, probably up to 4 million people getting the measles each year. That changed with the advent of the measles vaccine. And in 2000 in the United States, measles was eliminated by virtue of the definition that says it doesn't consistently spread over a longer than a 12-month period. So it's been eliminated since the year 2000, but there's still pockets of communities that are under-vaccinated where we see outbreaks, and we're currently seeing one of those, as you mentioned, in Texas and New Mexico primarily. More cases already this year than all of last year, more than 300. And amongst those cases, about almost one in five have been hospitalized, and unfortunately two deaths reported during the current year secondary to measles. And this is a vaccine-preventable illness, as you mentioned in the introduction. Two-dose vaccine, first one typically given at 12 to 15 months of age, second one at 4 to 6 years of age. One dose of the vaccine, 93% effective. Two doses, 97% effective. And this is against one of the most contagious viruses that we know of that exists. So to take you back, a long time ago, this was a disease that was life-threatening and quite prevalent. Today, eliminated from the United States, except typically in people who are under-vaccinated or not vaccinated at all. And that's true in this outbreak. Currently, 95% of people who are getting measles are unvaccinated or have unknown vaccination status.
So as I understand it, we'll take a break here, Dr. Fred. You can pick it up when we come back. Just to tell the history of this and put all this in context, it was considered eliminated in the United States in 2000, and I don't understand why we take a step backward. I can understand what happened and why that happened, but the logic of it as a parent just defies me. I think a lot of it has to do, and you can tell a story if you like when we come back, about the misinformation that's out there, falsified study that has since been disproven, although the guy never did retract it, as I understand it, in the UK about the measles vaccine. You got celebrities voicing their uneducated opinion on it. People.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous, but I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's. So thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy!
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Almacid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Almacid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almacid.com. That's almased.com.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. but that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Following, looking for a reason to blame their child's autism on. And also, I think the fact that, I don't know where the lawyers got involved in this, when you're a parent and you got to sign that release, the waiver, it does get your attention. But again, I think that's the legal part of it. And there is no medicine that is absolutely 100% safe for anybody. Pick it up. We come back with Dr. Fred Lopez. Measles party's not a good idea. Don't do it. And we'll also address why exposing your child to the measles is not the same as what they're exposed to in a vaccine. 720 traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about parents that are having uneducated parents and ill-informed parents having measles parties to expose their children to measles as opposed to getting the measles vaccine. But Dr. Fred Lopez, who is our friend and our guest, the professor, professor of medicine, section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. Dr. Fred, there's a big difference between what you're exposed to when you contact somebody with measles as opposed to what you're exposed to when you get the measles vaccine. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, the vaccine does contain a live version of the virus, but it's an attenuated or weaker version, as opposed to the virus that one encounters with natural infection, which can cause a lot of problems for patients who get infected. Most patients with measles are going to get high fever, cough, runny nose, maybe red eyes. Then they're going to get a rash. Some people's course of infection is complicated by ear infections and diarrhea, but there's some severe complications that you can get from measles that might result in hospitalization in about 20% of cases, like is currently being seen in the outbreak in the United States. Also pneumonia, swelling of the brain resulting in permanent neurologic deficits. And unfortunately, about 1 to 3 of every 1,000 children infected with measles can die. So that's why we really want to promote vaccination is a vaccine preventable illness is what measles is, and we should really lean on that to prevent further cases of measles. The vaccination rate amongst kindergartners, for example, in the state of Louisiana right now against measles is about 92.4%, meaning that we're below the level needed for herd immunity against measles, and that's the case that's being seen right now in Texas and New Mexico, as measles is spreading through those communities where there's under-vaccinated or not at all vaccinated children and adults.
What I think is ironic is that parents sometimes, due to misinformation and disinformation, avoid the measles vaccine because of a fear about their children, but yet talk, if you will, about SSPE that can lead to developmental disabilities as a result of having the measles from not being vaccinated.
Yeah, so SSPE is one of those neurologic or brain-associated complications of measles. What's interesting about it is that it occurs in people who have had the measles. The measles goes away, typically acquired earlier in life. And then about 7 to 10 years after the person has the measles, they develop this neurologic disease that unfortunately is uniformly fatal. And that's one of the more horrific complications of measles that we're aware of, in addition to the ones that I just mentioned. Again, this is a vaccine-preventable illness. We have a two-vaccine series that results in 97% effectiveness at reducing the risk for acquiring infection. Even if you are in that 3% who gets infected, you're going to have a milder illness than you would have if you had not been vaccinated. So we really need to promote the vaccination. As a state, we need to increase our levels of kindergartners being vaccinated in order to hopefully get us back to herd immunity levels so that we can prevent outbreaks in the future.
I'm up to date on COVID, on RSV, on rabies, distemper. I think I got everything I need, Doc. But somebody texted in about a booster shot for the measles. Do adults need those, older adults?
Typically not. If you've had at least one vaccine, which is what was recommended up until 1989, you're probably fine. In the setting of an outbreak, however, you may need a booster dose if you've only had one dose earlier in childhood, but not the second dose that's currently part of the universal recommendations for measles vaccine. All kids going into school nowadays should have gotten two doses of the measles vaccine, but previously that was not the case. So no, unless there's an outbreak around you, in which case you may be recommended to get a booster dose as an adult.
Thank you, Professor. Dr. Rather, I'm calling you Professor. I guess you're a professor as well. Dr. Fred Lopez, a professor in medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. Election season, well, the election's underway already. Early voting for the amendments that are on the ballot. We'll take a look at them from Barry Irwin's perspective, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for a Better Louisiana. Then we'll talk to Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative, and get her take on them when we come back. 7:30 time for WWL First News. All right, well, we got a little disconnection problem there, so we'll reconnect with Barry. Meanwhile, I'll remind you that you can celebrate New Orleans' best local music with WWL and Odyssey New Orleans at the Young Leadership Council's Wednesday at the Square. It all starts tomorrow. The weather, as I said, is going to be perfect. Concert series at Lafayette Square in the CBD, free, open to the public, showcases all your favorite local music and emerging artists, food, art, and crafts. It's festival time, time to unwind. Come hang out after work at Wednesday at the Square. Lafayette Square starting at 5 o'clock tomorrow. This week's band is Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes with No Babe. It's presented by Abita Brewing Company, the YLC, and WWL. And we are now joined by Barry Irwin, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for a Better Louisiana. How you doing, Barry?
Hey, good. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Is that different, your organization, is Leaders for a Better Louisiana different than Council for a Better Louisiana or not?
Yeah, well, sort of. We recently went through a merger with the Committee of 100 for Economic Development, which a lot of people might know that name as well. So I think we're trying to capture what we did at Cable with what the work of Committee of 100. So, yeah, it's a new group, though.
All right, let's talk about the – now I'm confused about the group. The Leaders for a Better Louisiana – and your thoughts on the amendments that are on the ballot. You want to go numerically or you want to go however you want to present it, Barry?
Oh, sure. Well, we can go numerically.
Hey.
I think amendment number one.
Been there, done that myself just now. So no problem with the dog. We're dog friendly here.
Well, I knew you must have to be. But yeah, amendment number
one. Who is that in the background, by the way?
My dog?
Yeah, who is it?
It's Ico.
Ico, what kind of dog is it?
Kind of a terrier mix with a rat terrier, a little kind of mix of that, and maybe a little Doberman. It's kind of weird.
Like a Sounds like a terrorist to me. Anyway, go ahead.
Very cute, Doug. Yeah, okay. Amendment number one deals with the judiciary, and it really does two things. One, it kind of validates or makes sure that it's clear that the Supreme Court has the authority to deal with or discipline out-of-state attorneys if they get out of hand. Not sure that's really necessary, but there's nothing wrong with that. But the other part is kind of a big part of it. It would allow the legislature to create regional or statewide courts of what's called specialized jurisdiction. So think of a juvenile court, a family court, a drug court, or now we've been hearing talk about a business court. This would allow the legislature to create these courts, which they can't do now except on a parish basis. They could do it on a – this would allow them to do it on a regional basis or statewide basis.
With an eye toward what?
Well, I think that's kind of the question. I think that was unclear during the testimony what was the goal. We heard talk about, well, other states have a business court. Well, we haven't had any discussion about having a business court. Most people don't even know what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, family courts and juvenile courts, the legislature and the local jurisdictions can create those now within the parish. So I think the question is, why do we need this right now, especially when we have what the legislative auditor says, more judges per capita than any of the states he looked at.
Yeah, my eyebrow went up. I don't know if you could raise it or not, because somebody had a reason for this. I don't know why, but somebody had a reason for it, and I would like to know what it is. I'm going to skip two, because that's the big one. We'll talk about that after the break. Let's talk about three, Barry, Amendment number three.
Yeah, this one, right now, if you're 17 years or older, you were tried as an adult automatically for felony crimes. You know, you're tried as an adult. But if you're 15 or 16, you're tried in juvenile court unless you commit one of a list of about 16 crimes that are in the Constitution. In those cases, you could be tried as an adult or you could be tried as a juvenile. Kind of depends on the circumstance. Mm-hmm. What this would do is take those 16 things that are listed in the Constitution and also in statute and say the legislature can now choose other crimes that 15 or 16-year-old kids can be tried for as adults. As it is now, voters would have to decide that. Under this, the legislature could decide that.
Okay, well, let me take a break. Do you have a position on that one?
We're opposed. We think let people decide.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of these are to give the legislature a lot more power, especially number two. We'll talk about that when we come back. Amendment number two. We're talking with Barry Irwin, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for a Better Louisiana. Amendment number two would really rewrite the state's tax code, and some people think is circumventing a constitutional convention. We'll see what Barry thinks when we come back. 751, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 757, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Barry Irwin, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for a Better Louisiana. And amendment number four concerns election dates for filing judicial vacancies. They support that. They oppose Amendment 3, which would determine the crimes which juveniles can be tried as adults. They oppose number 1, which sets up a business court, if you will. Let's talk about Amendment number 2, a big rewrite of the Louisiana Constitution and taxes. And it seems, Barry, to me, when it comes to the complexities of this, this is like you got to assign your trust to the legislature. Give me your thoughts on Amendment number 2.
Yeah, it's tough. It's unlike anything anybody has really been presented with since the Constitution. Our group supports it, and I'll tell you why. It does a lot of things, but it does a lot of things that reformers of the Constitution have been talking about for a long, long time. And a lot of that is to streamline this section of the document, put some of the stuff that's in the Constitution now in statute as opposed to the Constitution. I think people don't realize that most of the time when they go to vote on constitutional amendments, this is the article that they are amending because there's so much stuff in there. And, you know, our group just feels like it does, you know, a lot of good things. It's not perfect, but it does a lot of good things.
So it's in the best interest of whom to vote for this, I guess maybe would be a way to ask it.
Well, I think you can look at it in a couple of ways. If you're looking at taxes, it actually lowers the maximum amount of your income tax that can be charged without a constitutional change. from 4.75% to 3.75%. If you're a senior citizen, it doubles your standard deduction, which is a big change in your taxes. For teachers and for others, it pays down a ton of state debt that we have in the teacher retirement system, which is always a good thing because it frees up money for other purposes. But in this case, it's also going to make that teacher stipend that we've been having to carry over year after year, permanent. But I do think it does some things that are like reform-minded, putting things in the Constitution or taking things out. It doubles the size of the rainy day fund, raises the cap for how much we can put in there. Sure, there's some things that we wish they would have done a little differently. But when you look at it as a whole, we just think it does a lot of good things.
All right, and what about those who would say, well, maybe slow down, rethink this, rewrite it, do some things, those things that you say could have been done and shouldn't have been or were not done?
Yeah, I think it's hard for me to think that if we went through another experience of this whole thing that we would come out with something different or much better. And I worry that it would come out worse. I think we can work on the things that might need tweaking individually, but we should take a pretty good change, a pretty good document, and let's go forward.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you. Appreciate it. 8:15, beautiful morning, beautiful spring week ahead of us, so enjoy it while you can, because it's going to be summertime before long. It'll be the Louisiana legislative session before long. But
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor superfan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Before that, you got an election, an election on amendments. Let's just get the Louisiana State Representative Mandy Landry, shall we? She can get me out of the hole I've talked myself into. Good morning, Representative. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How's it going?
Everything's going well. And you?
Yeah, having a nice little sunny, beautiful Tuesday morning.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I should tell people, of course, you're a graduate of Notre Dame University, Georgetown Law, and since it's New Orleans, blank high school, because that's what really matters to everybody here. Let's talk about the constitutional amendments, Mandy, and your take on 1 through 4. You can take them in whatever order you want. 1 is the one that establishes some kind of like different regional court or something like that. What's all that about, do you know?
Yeah, so all 4 amendments in general were rushed through. They didn't need to be done when they were. For people wondering why you're voting in this low turnout March election, part of the reason is people pushing it did not want these amendments on the October ballot, and that is because New Orleans is voting for our local city council, mayor, that sort of thing. So think about that when you vote, why you're voting and no one else's. But 1 is super concerning to me, especially because people who are encouraging you to vote for it don't tell you the whole story about it. It does 2 things that are unrelated. One of the things it does is say that judges can punish out-of-state lawyers, and it's ludicrous. We need that in our Constitution because we already do that. If you're an out-of-state lawyer trying to practice here and you're being bad, the judge won't let you practice anymore. Makes sense, right? Pretty simple. Mm-hmm. The second thing it does is create specialty courts, and I noticed when the governor and even the Young Republicans have talked about Amendment 1, they don't mention specialty courts. When the gentleman from the Pelican Institute was here last week. Yeah, I know. I always screw that up. He didn't mention specialty courts. And what's a specialty court? Well, it's going to be in the Constitution, undefined. We have drug courts that are defined. We have mental health courts. People have heard of veterans courts that help veterans with a host of criminal issues, and those are all defined. But this is an undefined term. Do you want to leave that to the legislature? Here are some things the legislature could do with an undefined specialty court. How about a court that deals with all insurance claims and only insurance claims? So every time you have a hurricane claim or a car accident claim, it goes to a special court with appointed judges. That's my issue with Amendment 1.
Appointed by?
The governor or whoever he asked to go find judges. Yep, because all of our judges are elected, and some are better than others. But if we don't like a judge, we can kick him out of office. We can go find new ones. But an appointed judge the public has no say in it. So if you have an insurance claim, yes?
You were at the legislature. You know who was pushing for this. What's the idea behind this? Who was pushing for this and who wants this?
We can only guess, because whenever someone asks, what do you want to do? What's a specialty court? The response was, well, we don't know. We have to set it up first. We can't do anything without setting it up first. And that's kind of nonsense, as we see in Louisiana law. Like I said, the legislature has set up drug courts and mental health courts and veterans courts. We think that there's probably some sort of, quote, business court idea that sends big businesses to a separate system. Those do exist. But, for example, Georgia asked its voters, do you want to set up a business court system? And the voters said yes. And they asked them very specifically about a business court. But because this is undefined, I do think it gives the legislature way too much power, frankly, over the judiciary.
Leaders for a Better Louisiana, we just had Barry Irwin on. They oppose Amendment Number 1. Let me move on to Amendment Number 3. Legislative authority to determine the crimes for which juveniles can be tried as adults. The Council for, what did I just say? Leaders for a Better Louisiana say they oppose that as well. Tell me, Mandy Landry, about Amendment 3.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Bedfellows, on this one in particular, and too, that some of your further right religious groups have aligned with a lot of my left friends. Right now in the Constitution, there's a long list of violent crimes that says that the district attorney can send a juvenile to adult prison for rape, murder, and anything violent. We Louisiana voters voted to put that list of crimes in the Constitution, the specific list of deadly crimes. Or very violent crimes into the Constitution. We said those are situations where a juvenile needs to go to adult prison. This amendment would remove the list of crimes and allow a DA to send a juvenile to adult prison in the adult court system for pretty much any crime. That's a lot of power to give to someone, especially in some of these far-flung places where history might be a little bit behind. Supposedly, according to some, law enforcement groups, we need it. But then when the legislature asked the author of the bill on the floor why we needed the bill, she really couldn't explain it. So this is another one that even if people aren't for it, I would say, you know what, give us some time. Let's figure out what's going on here, why we're really doing this. And are we giving the legislature, again, too much power?
All right, speaking of time, we're going to take a break here, and I want to save some time to talk about Amendment Number 2, which is a big rewrite of Louisiana Constitution, and the time that was allotted to put this all together and the process involved, because you were there at the Capitol, Mandy, and talked about slowing down everything else when this happened. Mandy Landry, Democrat, Louisiana State Representative, giving us her take on the amendments and the process involved. More when we return, 8:22, Traffic Now, WWL. 8:27, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative, talking about the constitutional amendments on the ballot. Mandy, Number 2 is the big one. The floor is yours.
Is it ever? It's the amendment you're going to vote on has something like 90-something words, and the bill itself is over 100 pages. This is a big deal. This is essentially, Amendment 2 is essentially a rewrite of Article 7 of our Constitution, which is all about taxes. When we redid our Constitution in the 70s, it took about 2 years to redo the whole Constitution. So to redo an entire article about money in the span of 2 weeks when no one was really paying attention, cram it all in, done by a few people, is a bad idea. And when I say done by a few people, it was done by people who really wanted what they really wanted. I'm on the Tax Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, along with Rep. Willard from Gentilly. We're the two Orleans members on it. Mm-hmm. We weren't invited to a single meeting. I saw the draft of that bill when everyone else saw it, and there's plenty that we could have agreed on. This bill, it touches personal income tax, corporate income tax. So it does away with most corporate income tax. There's two taxes. It's over $1 billion a year we will not collect in corporate income tax. It it combines or does away with several funds, some related to education. It says it's giving the teachers a raise. Guess what, Tommy? We can give teachers a raise the very first day of session. I don't like how they're using teachers here. Essentially here, what's happening is you have people who've wanted to do a lot of things to our tax system for a long time, and some of those are probably very necessary. But to package together like that and mislead people and not explain everything to people is, I think it's wrong. I mean, I don't even know all of the provisions that are in it because it changed so many times since we first saw it. I just caution people, look, if you are not sure about an amendment ever, don't vote for it. That means we can go back and try again.
To be clear, you're not saying there aren't changes that could be made. You're saying this is no way to go about it?
Absolutely. We do need to make changes. We have a crazy tax code. We really do. But the way we're going about it, with a lack of input, essentially from differing views, and by packaging everything together, differing things and things that don't need to be in there, like a teacher pay raise that are going to distract people, this is not the way to do it. We need time to do this. And like I said, I mean, most of the reason it was pushed through is because it needed to be on this ballot and not on the ballot in October when New Orleans elects a mayor.
Biggest concern about unintended consequences of this or direct consequences of this?
That we might go broke sooner than we think we might. We are not getting any more federal money for a while or for an indefinite amount of time. So we need the money, and this is going to really tighten the belt, maybe more than we intended.
Thank you, Mandy. Appreciate your time and your insight as always. Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative. We're going to take a break. We come back. Boy, you want to get involved in something, a volunteer. Jefferson Parish needs CASA advocates, and we'll talk about that when we return, 8:30. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 9-11 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Margaret Ether, advocate recruiter for CASA Jefferson. They need volunteers, and boy, if you're looking to volunteer and you can, this is one of the more noble things and helpful things that you could do. Good morning, Margaret. How you doing? Good to talk to you again.
Good morning. Good morning.
Tell me about what CASA is and what being a CASA volunteer entails.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Again, CASA, I'm Margaret Ether, the advocate recruiter for CASA Jefferson. CASAs are court-appointed special advocates for children in foster care. We work with children. I need volunteers for children that's been taken from their parents due to abuse and neglect and in need of somebody to be a voice for them. You have to be 21 years or older. It doesn't interfere with your job. You make sure that all of that child's basic needs are being met while in foster care. You don't put children in your car. You don't bring them to your house. You don't take care of them. As I said earlier, you make sure that all of that child's basic needs are being met. There's a 5-chapter class that you have to complete. We make sure that you understand what you're doing to help a child feel like it's not their fault. And you do make a difference. You change a child's story from the negative to the positive. And I have 30-plus children that need to volunteer. So I'm putting my heart out to you this morning. If you don't know your purpose, find your purpose. Everybody has a purpose to help somebody make a difference in their life, because somebody made a difference in your life. So come on, everybody. Help CASA Jefferson out by volunteering with us and help us with our children.
What kind of commitment are they looking at, Margaret?
Well, what we're asking is that you complete a case. It's like a 2-year commitment. As I said, it doesn't interfere with your job. I have a lot of people that work full-time that has taken on the task to help us make a difference with our children. So we're asking that you complete a case. Cases normally don't last but a month, 2 months, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. And that's what we're asking you to help us make that difference and change that child's story.
Margaret, for people that think that maybe they want to do it, maybe they don't, is there some kind of discernment thing that goes on, or an information session where they can get, you know, like sitting through it and see what exactly is involved?
Good question. Yes, there's an informational session that's conducted by our executive director, Wendy McGee, and that helps you to learn more about CASA. You can ask questions in the informational session. It helps you to understand the full capacity of what you're going to help us do. You can also go to the website, www.casajefferson.org. You can go online and do an email, send me an email. margaretisa@castlejefferson.org, or you can call 504-533-8757 and talk to me. The information session is just what it says, information about CASA. You get all of the basic information to help you understand. And I do know being a volunteer is not for everyone, but the informational sessions allow you to make a decision and to understand how very important you are in helping us with our children.
Somebody texted in, Margaret, do you have to live in Jefferson to be a Jefferson CASA volunteer?
No, you don't. CASAs are throughout Louisiana. We're here in Jefferson Parish, and that's my pitch for Jefferson Parish, but CASAs are everywhere.
Tell me again about the sessions. How do people find out about them, and what time commitment does that take just to sit through the session or see if this is something that they would be interested in doing?
The session may last anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes. You can sit at your office desk. Signed up, go to the website and sign up for the informational session. Our executive director, Wendy McGee, will be on the informational session. I will too. You can ask as many questions as you want to get you more information about CASA, why we do what we do. As I said, CASAs are court-appointed special advocates. They work with children that's been taken from their parents. We need you to help us. It's desperate times. Our children are going so much the left direction. We need you to help us bring our children to the right direction, which is the right, and give them some guidance and understanding.
And is it a Zoom thing, or can you do it at whenever you want?
Well, no. The five-chapter class, are in-house. One class is you have to go to court observation. Those other classes are Zoom classes. Our next class starts in May. And I'm pushing for May to be a full class so we can help the 30-plus children that's on our waiting list.
And I meant the informational part of it, Margaret, the 15- to 20-minute thing. Can that you access that whenever you want?
Well, it's scheduled when you put in your application or your for the informational session. It's usually on a Tuesday or Thursday between 11 and 12 o'clock. It don't take long. You just learn more about CASA, why we do what we do, and how much we need you to help us.
Margaret, God bless you for all you do. We'll help you whenever we can. Believe me, CASAJefferson.org, CASAJefferson.org, if you can help. Thank you, Margaret. I hope we fill it up for May.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
You bet. Appreciate you. We'll take a break for traffic now, 855 W. Yeah, I thanked earlier the engineers for all of their work with the upgrading of WWL, pardon me, and also all of Tim Zimmer and Jordan Fiegel and everybody, and the displaced WWL diaspora as it relates to getting everybody back at the studio. And I also thank TEDDY, the PUPPY, for his good behavior. And I can't say his name or he's going to get all acted up and so forth, or start acting up. But I'm out of pocket about $120 on chewable treats. Yes. And what's interesting is that if you go to these pet places, one side of the store is very pet friendly, right? But if you go to the other side, they had got all of these rendered animal parts that you could probably put a cow back together if you bought every. Yes. It always struck me how, well, we're very pet-friendly over here, but on the other, very animal-friendly over here, but yet when you go to the other side, not so much. Yeah. Well, you can have a cow for a pet, I guess. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe the line is if you eat it or not, but then again, you get to cultures. Let's just keep moving with Jeff Nowak, please. Thank you, Dave. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saint Sideline Reporter, always a good follow at Jeff Nowak on X or Twitter. How you doing, Jeff Nowak, WWL Saint Sideline Reporter?
I'm doing good. I also have to say, great use of diaspora. I was not expecting to have that vocabulary lesson in my morning, but it was a good one.
But it's true, don't you think? We're displaced,
yeah, no,
we're displaced people. We're nomads. We're wandering at this point.
Right.
We're looking for some great leader to lead us out of the... Anyway, let's talk about the running back that the Saints signed. I got his pronunciation and I lost it. Jay, tell me who it is.
Velus Jones?
Yeah.
Is that who we're talking about? Yeah, yes. Velus Jones. You know, he's an interesting... Go ahead.
Well, is there another one?
Well, no, it's that's the Jones is pretty easy to pronounce.
No, I mean another running back that the Saints. Let's start with Jeff Nowak. I'm gonna press the reset button. I'm just kidding. Did they sign another running back or just Velus Jones?
I believe it was just Velus Jones, unless okay. I missed something. And Velus, he's an interesting guy. You know, he was a third round pick, 71st out of USC, and then I think he went to Tennessee. But he came out as a wide receiver last year. So, and I only know this because I watched the Hard Knocks on the Bears, where Velus Jones was, and they transitioned him from wide receiver to running back, and there was this kind of long arc of him transitioning to running back. He's kind of big for a running back. He's 6'3", 201, which, you know, you don't see a lot of 6'3" running backs because you kind of want to get low. It's a center of gravity position. But the Saints are bringing him in as a running back. They're not bringing him in as a wide receiver. He could be a return specialist. So it's interesting. And I think it kind of follows the theme of, okay, we have this team that is saying, hey, we want to be active in free agency. We're going to bring guys in, but we're not going to overspend. We're not going to do a ton beyond the minimum in terms of contracts. You know, you signed Justin Reed to a bigger contract. You signed Juwan Johnson, Chase Young to bigger extensions, three-year extensions. But otherwise, they've been pretty subdued. You know, there have been some guys they've been in on, but, you know, like Cooper Kupp, for instance, but the market got too high, so they pulled back. So I think this is kind of where you're at right now, is you're trying to find, I don't want to say bargain bin options, but kind of more economically friendly options, because this to me is a team that is still kind of understanding where it is and that there's a rebuild going on.
Well, you got to live within your means, right? I mean,
well, to an extent, I mean, they could go out and spend. There's nothing preventing them from doing that. They have, you know, there's a couple contracts that haven't come in yet from a dollars perspective. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're showing with about $18 million in cap space. I think once you factor in guys like Justin Reed and, you know, wherever they end up signing, Velus Jones and Will Clapp and Jonah Williams, you're in top 51 range right now. So basically only the top 51 salaries count toward the salary cap. Mm-hmm. So these guys would probably bump a few of those lower level contracts down, and you would probably end up losing, I don't know, $4 to $5 million against the cap space you have. So I guess they have about $14 million, give or take, right now in real effective cap space. So if they wanted to, they could go out and be aggressive and sign a couple guys. I think they're choosing to be a little bit more, choosy, I think it would be a word, in terms of they're not going to go out and get into a bidding war. Cooper mm-hmm. Kupp was a guy they were in on. He was signed for 3 years, $45 million. That's too much for a guy in his situation. Hasn't played more than 12 games since the 2021 season. It would have been great to have him in here, but not at that number. So I think that's where you are. A guy like Keenan Allen is still out there that really intrigues me. Was on the Chargers with Kellen Moore in 2023, kind of fits that mold that I think the Saints should be looking for in the bigger receiver. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's money in the till. It's just a question of whether they want to go grab it.
Interesting that Velus Jones is a pet ferret, because to me, have you ever known anybody that's had a ferret, Jeff?
I haven't, but I've always been fond of ferrets whenever I go to the pet
really?
Store. I think his ferret's name is Crash. Because I think he confused it with Crash Bandicoot, I think, is the story. Because I don't think he knew what a bandicoot was. And I don't know, if you didn't know any better, you would think a ferret and a bandicoot was the same thing. But anyway, yeah, he's got a ferret. He's an interesting guy, for sure.
I dated a woman one time, had a ferret, and you knew it as soon as you walked in the house. And apparently that's a common thing with ferrets. I think it's the worst of a snake and a rat combined, but that's just my opinion. Let's talk about, and I said you're a good follow on Twitter, and you really are, @Jeff_Nowak. Because you say, hey, I'm going to read this tweet. I want you to expand on it because I think it's a good one. Hot take here. If teams would actually stick to their guns and not reset the market with every third contract, the overall NFL product would be better for it. And I think sometimes, yeah, I guess the other side of that is collusion, where they can't get together and collude. That would not be technically with the collective bargaining agreement. But I think you make a good point here. Expand on that a little bit, Jeffrey, if you would.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, it's not even, you know, I made that point on a Derek Stingley tweet, because Derek Stingley signed a $30 million a year contract with the Texans, and he's now the highest paid cornerback in the NFL. And, you know, I don't even think it's a good point to be made on a Derek Stingley. It's like when you're getting annoyed at something and then something benign happens mm-hmm. and you go fly off the handle, and it's like, well, it's not really about that. It's about all these other things. And,
no,
but it's just,
I
know,
agree, but generally speaking, I think it's a good point.
Right, and so basically the point is, you know, teams have just gotten way too willing to just throw record-setting contracts at every star-level free agent they have. And it's creating a scenario where, so like, look at the Bengals. The Bengals are now paying 60% of their salary cap to their quarterback and their top two wide receivers. Well, you got to build an offensive line. You got to build a defensive line. You got to build a defense. I guess if you're playing fantasy football, it's great because they're going to have to go out there and outscore everybody. So I'm going to draft Joe Burrow and T. Higgins and Ja'Marr Chase. But how are you going to build a team that way? And it's creating a scenario where you have these really top-heavy teams that when you have two or three bad injuries, like bad luck injuries, you can't completely go in the tank because you cannot survive them. You cannot build a roster that is dedicated to this system with the players you need because you can't afford them. All you can do is bring in guys on minimum contracts. Every time you sign somebody to one of these record-setting deals, it takes, I don't know what the number would be, maybe four or five players who would be on reasonable kind of mid-range contracts and dumps them down to a minimum contract that can be shed immediately. So it means that roster turnover is higher. So your teams are playing with players they are not used to. And if you go watch like the Patriots, one of the reasons the Patriots were so good for so long is because they had a core of players that played together. And even when they had to replace parts, you had a system that you could build around. When you are playing with three massive contracts, you're basically just filling in parts around those guys, and you can't build a team, you can't build a structure. And then every time a player gets to free agency, they're like, well, I want to reset the market. That guy did. I'm as good as he is. So it's just a vicious cycle that kind of builds and builds and builds to the point that, I mean, I don't think that's why you look at this, the NFL as it is right now. You see, you know, some really good teams and then a whole bunch of really bad teams. The Saints went 5-12 and they're picking ninth. That means there are eight NFL teams that finish worse than 5-12. There should not be, in a league that strives for parity, that big of a gulf between playoff teams and non-playoff teams. And that's what you have. And I think the teams getting more and more top-heavy is a reason for that, because teams just have no interest in being in the middle anymore. They just want to be either at the top or the bottom. And so, yeah, anyway, it's a whole problem. Now, the Texans can get away with it right now because they're not paying the quarterback. Because C.J. Stroud is going into year three, so he's on a rookie deal. Once they have to pay the quarterback, you can't do that anymore. And now quarterbacks are making $60-plus million. Salary cap goes up by $15 million every year. So, you know, you can survive, but I don't know. I just think it's bad roster management, and teams are just not willing to stick to their guns. Players are willing to hold out, and then they don't have a choice. So I don't know. It's an ugly system, and it's one of the reasons I appreciate the way the Saints operate. Because one of the things they do is they set a number and they kind of stick to it. And I think that's how you should, that's how more teams should be operating.
It seems to me like an analogy would be three couples that fall in love with a house and they artificially drive the price of it up. And then whoever winds up with it realizes when they move in what they have and how they have to deal with the plumbing issues, this, that, the other thing. Make sense?
Along with the other expenses. They could have got the house next door for half the price.
Exactly right. My point. And then they realize after it's all over, well wait a minute, I guess we won. Let's talk about the guy from New England, Davon Gotcha. How you say his name?
I believe it's Davon. I could be wrong. Davon. I need to double check. And I want to say it's Gotcha or something along those lines, but you know, there's the whole Cajun of it all. But yeah, I mean, he's a local guy. He kind of fills this theme that, I don't know if this is what the Saints were going for, but this is definitely what happened, is kind of this homecoming theme of this offseason, right? Justin Reed, Louisiana guy, didn't go to LSU, went to Stanford, but his brother is Eric Reed, who played with Tyrann Mathieu at LSU, right? Like, Bo Davis is a new defensive line coach. You bring in Davon Gotcha, who played for the Dolphins and the Patriots, but went to high school, you know, played at Plaquemine, went to LSU, so just another Louisiana guy. So, you know, it's kind of a homecoming of sorts for these guys. And, you know, he's interesting because the Patriots were kind of just trying to ship him out. Like, they changed head coaches. Clearly, this wasn't going to be a fit. And I think what happens in that situation is you're like, okay, we could cut him, but why don't we make some calls first? And the Saints were like, hey, we'll give you a 2026 seventh rounder, which is, you know, about the lowest level asset you can give and still call it a trade, right? You got to trade something. You know, there's no such thing, like they say, like, oh, a bag of balls. Like, that's essentially what it is. Like, you're just throwing him something to say it was a trade so you can jump the line rather than having to go after the guy in free agency. And that's what they did. Davon said the Saints were the most aggressive. He wanted to come here. He thought it would be a cool opportunity to come home. So it kind of fits. And you look at what Brandon Staley needs to do, the new Saints defensive coordinator. They're going to run a 3-4 to some in some capacity. It's going to be kind of a hybrid scheme. So, you know, we're not going to be running just a legit 3-4 front all the time. Anytime you go into nickel, you're going to have five defensive backs on the field, and that's going to change things. But you did need a nose tackle. And I feel like that's what Devon is going to come in and kind of be your primary nose tackle. So he's going to be on the field a good bit. He's more of a run player. He describes himself as a dirty work player, which is what any nose tackle should describe them as themselves as. Because, you know, basically what you're doing is trying to occupy double teams. Like,
right.
In most cases, you're not even going to be a factor on the play because you're getting taken out of the play. If you're not drawing a double team, then you do have to go make a play because someone else is getting double teamed and they're saying, hey, we're going to pick you as the guy who needs to beat us. But in most cases, you're just kind of getting driven off the play. So no, I think it's a good addition for them.
That's otherwise known as a three tech, right? Where you occupy the interior lineman so somebody else can get through?
No, a three tech would be your traditional defensive tackle in a 4-3. So like Brian Brzee would have been playing the three technique this year. A nose tackle would be, you know, kind of a one, you know, or a zero, you know, you're just kind of over the center, basically, or you're shaded mm-hmm. from one side or the other. And the center is usually going to get help from one side or the other because teams typically don't want to leave the center one-on-one. So, I mean, it's just you want someone who can play in the middle of the line. And then what that would mean is your defensive ends are now what would be kind of your defensive tackles previously. So a Brian Brzee would bump out to what's now a defensive end in a 3-4. And then, you know, your edges would be your outside linebackers. And that would be probably a Chase Young or Carl Granderson in that situation.
Don't ever correct me, Jeff. Please, don't ever. Just go along with it. No. So tell me about Juwan Johnson real quick, and where do the Saints go from here?
Yeah, so Juwan, you know, Juwan's another interesting case because, you know, he said yesterday he had interest from several other teams. Sean Payton was coming to get him for the Broncos. Clint Kubiak and the Seahawks were looking at him. So guys with connections to the Saints, obviously, were interested in him. But he wanted to stay in New Orleans. You know, he talked about how he was really on the fence. It was really draining on him because he was trying to figure out what to do. And he actually called Kellen Moore at like 11:30 at night one night, just out of the blue. They hadn't really talked at all, but he was just like he couldn't sleep and he needed to like get it off his chest. They called him and Kellen took the call and they talked for like a half hour. And he kind of said like that. It didn't make the decision, but it was like the commitment it showed for just him taking the call and talking to him and kind of reassuring him in that moment was like, all right, this is where I want to be. So I don't know. I thought that was kind of an interesting story because I think a lot of times these decisions are very emotional. It's oftentimes not about the money. And, you know, it is about the money, but not about the money in the sense that, okay, what's the real difference between, you know, if he got 3 years, $30 million, what if someone was offering him 2 years, $23 million, right? Like it's really tangibly about the same. But no, he feels like there's more to do in New Orleans. I think what he said and what I think the team is kind of showing with that contract is, hey, we believe your best years are still ahead of you. You know, it's a guy who came into the league as a wide receiver, switched to tight end in year two. And so those first 2 years were really kind of an experiment. You only have the last 3-4 years to really kind of get an idea of what he can do. He had his most catches and yards this past season. He led the Saints in receiving yards a couple of years ago. I think he had 9 touchdowns or something in that range. He led the team in touchdown receptions. So there's a lot to like. What he needs to do is put a whole season together, right? Like he'll have these stretches where you're like, well, why doesn't he do that all the time? And that's what he needs to do. And when he understands that is he needs to come in and be that weapon for 17 games and not just a 6 games out of a 17 game season. But no, I think that's what the Saints are investing is. They're investing in saying, hey, we're paying him for the next 3 years and we expect those to be his best 3 years. And I think the same thing is true for Chase Young, a 25-year-old who's, you know, they feel like it's just coming into his own. So I think that's kind of the measured rebuild that the Saints are in right now is you're investing in guys that you think are going to – their best football is still there, and you're making sensible decisions elsewhere. But I know Juwan is happy to stick around. I know the Saints are happy to keep him around.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Good follow on Twitter at Jeff_NOWAK. We'll take a quick break. We come back. We're going to talk to Ross Dellinger, Yahoo Sports senior writer, about LSU, NIL, and professional college football players is basically what it is. Tommy Tucker back in a flash. All right, here we go. 9:33, 27 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to Ross Dellinger, Yahoo Sports senior writer. Used to be the LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Good to talk to you, Ross. How are you?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Let's talk about your story here at Yahoo.com. It's a money game now, how LSU is going to use NIL to keep up in ever-evolving college football world. Boy, it's like you can look at this from the higher level, which is the House settlement, and what happens after that. Then you can look at it from the LSU level and how they're handling all of that. How you want to go here, Ross? You want to start with the House settlement and salary caps? Or I don't know, man. This is complicated stuff. You tell me.
Yeah, it's it definitely is complicated. Yeah, I think to understand the LSU piece, you have to understand the House settlement and what it is and the revenue sharing concept that's coming to college athletics. And so I'll start there. I mean, basically, you know, the NCAA has been sued for years and years and has lost a lot of these lawsuits. And a lot of these lawsuits have been about providing more compensation to athletes. And I think they're tired of losing those lawsuits, so they decided to settle the latest one. And that's the House case. It's actually got two more cases involved in it. And the settlement is kind of two parts. You know, one part is back damages. So $2.8 billion in back pay will go to former athletes who are owed NIL money, basically, before NIL was legal. And then the forward pay is what we're really talking about, what we spent time on that story about, which is it basically just abolishes the NCAA's rules around paying players, and it permits schools to pay players. And there's a salary cap as part of the settlement agreement. $20.5 million each school will have in year one. That figure will rise. It's got escalators. So year one, it's $20.5 million that each school will have to spend on their athletes. And that will start July 1, along with a new enforcement entity that will police all deals outside of school payments. So athletes can still strike commercial and endorsement deals outside of the school and earn more money than what the school pays them. So in a way, the school can exceed the salary cap if their athletes generate, or if they generate for their athletes, more money outside of the cap. So that's kind of how it works. You know, the LSU piece of this, our story was mainly about how LSU has raised all this money, you know, in between $10 and $15 million is kind of a floating figure over the last few months to front load to athletes before the settlement gets implemented on July 1, before the new enforcement entity is implemented. So it's, you know, a lot of schools are doing this. I would say most of the power conferences are front loading, and that just means paying players before July 1, paying them a lot, right? Shifting some of these contract payments that are like annual contracts where you get paid over a year, and probably 80% of the payments are coming before July 1. So that's front loading the contract. And they're doing that to kind of, for two reasons, to avoid the new enforcement entity that's going to be more strict, but also to give flexibility to their revenue share in the years following, right? If they front load all this money now, they can use the rev share and push that money next year when they have that. So it is all complicated. But the bottom line of the story is LSU has raised a lot of money very quickly to position themselves in the long term to pay their players more and stay competitive.
So when we talk about front loading, what I hear is it's the wild, wild west right now. There are no rules. Front load, prepay as much as you possibly can before whatever rules there are kick into place and kick into effect or whatever it is. And then even those rules are kind of flexible because you got a salary cap, but NIL money is separate and distinct. Accurate or not?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, the front loading concept, you know, if you pay out your 2025 roster, if you pay 80% out to them before July 1, then, you know, starting on July 1, you have a fresh $20.5 million through June 2026 to spend on your roster and on your 2026 roster because you've already paid your 2025 through the front loading, or a big portion of your 2025 through the front loading. So it gives you some flexibility. It stretches your revenue share figures, your dollar further, is what it does. And a lot of schools, like I said, a lot of schools are doing it. LSU's not the only one. A lot of schools are doing it even more, right, than LSU. LSU estimates to spend $10 to $12 million probably this spring, in front loading money to their 2025 roster. I think there's some schools spending upwards to $16 to $18 million before July 1 arrives.
Somebody texted and said they're still paying kids under the table to cheat the salary cap. Somebody texted that in. But to be clear, nobody's paying anybody under the table. There are, for all intents and purposes, no rules now, so you can do whatever you want. Yeah. Accurate?
Yeah, there's no reason to pay anybody under the table anymore, right? Now, there will be reason to do it starting potentially on July 1 if you want to exceed the cap and cannot come up with legitimate NIL deals for your athletes to exceed the cap. Then the only other way to exceed the cap would be to pay players outside of the school secretly. So history repeats itself, right? So we could see that starting again, we could see players under the new kind of salary cap, revenue share concept, to be paid under the table. I think most schools, before they would do that, they would try to find real NIL deals from their athletes. You know, this new enforcement entity that's starting will have a clearinghouse. We've written exhaustively about it. And it's going to be stricter on booster payments for NIL. So it's got to be real NIL. It's got to be real endorsement commercial deals that athletes are signing in order for it to pass this clearinghouse. And that's part of why, right, schools are front-loading too. Before the new enforcement entity arrives July 1, you get all this money out that doesn't fall under the scrutiny of this enforcement entity. But starting July 1, that person that texted in probably is right. Yeah, I mean, we could be back to how we were years ago where certainly athletes were paid secretly under the table, whatever vocabulary you want to use to get money to them.
Even at that, Ross, I'm thinking about the NIL thing, and it's so subjective. What's a legitimate NIL thing? I mean, you're looking at basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but bang for your buck for your advertising, right? So who's to say if a second-string defensive tackle, a Bill Depth, is really worth $100,000 to push Joe's lawn cutting service, but right? I mean, am I missing something here or not?
Yeah. Well, I think the new clearinghouse, this new enforcement entity that's supposed to determine if NIL deals outside of the school are real or not, certainly has some legal issues. I think many lawyers would say that it won't stand up to the legal test, that if it rejects deals by businesses, boosters, brands, because they're not, you know, fair market value, or they're not in the quote compensation range that they deem it to be, then there'll be lawsuits. There'll be more lawsuits. And I think that's probably what we're looking at, is that
as soon as
the deals are rejected, there'll be legal challenges.
Who's to tell me how I want to spend my advertising dollar, right? And I say that tongue in cheek, but legally, I mean, it's true.
That's right. Yeah, and the clearinghouse is run by Deloitte. The NCAA and the power conferences have hired Deloitte to run this clearinghouse. They've come up with these fair market value and compensation range concepts, but you know they seem to be confident in it. But many people are not, and believe that it will not stand up to the legal smell test.
Well, in that case, Ross, I would only respond with my one word West Bank legal phrase, which is bra. Let me take a break. Mm. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Ross Dellinger about LSU. We'll specifically talk about where LSU is getting the money and how they're going to break it up in-house after the House settlement. Ross Dellinger, Yahoo Sports senior writer. It's a mess. It's going to be a mess. And that's the world we live in. Talking about LSU and NIL and House settlement and more, 9:43, a little bit late, time for traffic on WWL. 9:50, 10 till 10. Quickly back to Ross Dellinger, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about LSU and NIL and front loading and all that stuff. Ross, we only have a couple of minutes left. I hope you come back because we could talk about this for 8 hours. It's so complicated. How does LSU intend to split up the money in-house as it relates to different sports?
Yeah, it's a great question. Schools are doing it all fairly similarly. They're using the back damage formula, what plaintiff's lawyers are, how they're splitting the back damage pay and how settlement going forward. So about 75% of the $20.5 million will be spent on football, about 15% on men's basketball, and about 10% split among the other sports, probably leading with women's basketball. So that's how, and that's Scott Woodward, the LSU athletic director, said that's about how he plans to spend LSU's $20.5 million in the year one, which would equate about to around $14 million for the football roster and about probably $3 million for basketball, men's basketball. And then so on, you know, probably around $1 million or so for women's basketball. And then the other 5% is kind of left to be dispersed among the other sports. And LSU will add more scholarships, you know, as part of the House settlement. You can scholarship an entire roster now. And so LSU will add more scholarships. I'd imagine there'll be a lot more scholarships added to things like baseball, you know, at LSU.
Who are some of the bigger contributors to all of this for LSU?
Yeah, you know, it takes a lot of
money.
Donor money, right, to do this stuff. Yeah, and
lots of money.
Yes, and it will continue, you know, the front loading aspect of it was very important. The way LSU fundraised all this money early on, which was Brian Kelly and the general manager, Austin Thomas, getting out and raising money with donors, right? And it was a handful of 3 to 5 donors, some of them very much known, like Todd Graves and the Canes, Raising Canes, and Gordon McKernan of the McKernan Law Firm there in Baton Rouge. And then some others who aren't as known, right? And like Holden Spate, who lives in San Francisco, but is a big LSU fan and a Baton Rouge native, and kind of a private equity guy. He certainly donated his fair share. And Pepper Rutland, who owns, I think, the largest in America equipment manufacturing equipment tools company, and so they've all donated. Probably 7 figures, you know, in this latest campaign.
Just amongst the SEC, because we only have a second left here, who's winning when it comes to all of this front loading and everything else? Football, specifically football, who's winning, if you had to say?
I think that, you know, Tennessee and the University of Texas and probably Texas A&M are toward the top when it comes to their football NIL type of budget. If you look at the last several years, you know, they're probably anywhere from 15 to 20 million for their football roster. You know, I think in the new rev share era, they'll probably be out front when it comes to devising ways to exceed the cap by finding authentic, real, you know, NIL deals for players.
It's going to be a mess. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you, Ross Dellinger, Yahoo Sports senior writer, who's, got to have a staff to keep track of all of this. I can't even imagine beginning to track all of this. 9:54, 6 till 10, quick break, then we'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.